You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Montauk ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire Maranga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, tērā tōru o Hui Tanguru. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire for today, February 3rd on 95 BFM. And I'm Justin Wong, your host for today. And joining me is my producer, Joe Wickens. How are you doing?
Doing good. How are we doing?
Yeah, doing very well. Happy Lunar New Year.
Happy Lunar New Year.
Yeah, so happy Lunar New Year to all of them, and I hope you have a great Year of the Tiger. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, Joe will be looking at the recent submissions to the Health Sector Reform Bill by the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission. The Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses are opposing the Taranaki Cup, and the government has announced a new job insurance scheme. Proposals for a new jobs insurance scheme while New Zealand citizens are still stuck in Afghanistan. As usual, he aha ofakaro, let me know what you are thinking. Tuku patu hi mai, you can do so by texting me on 5395 or wai mai rane, call me on 309-3879. Ko wa e waere waere e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakihire roki roki marunga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. As always, you can catch all these stories and other shows by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēnā wā tonu. Now let's get on with the show.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
The government is planning to set up an employment insurance plan in which people who were laid off or lost their jobs could have as much as 80% of their former income for up to 7 months. The scheme will be run by the ACC and funded by 1.39 cents on every dollar earned by employees and businesses. It is supported by an unlikely alliance between Business New Zealand and the Council of Trade Unions, but welfare advocates say the plan would only drive inequality. Joining me to talk about that now is Associate Professor Mike O'Brien, who is the Child Poverty Action Group's Social Security spokesperson. Kia ora, Mike, and thanks for joining us. So what is exactly wrong with the plan?
I think there's two or three key issues really. The first one is that what it does is that it creates another tier in the social welfare system. So you've got a social security benefits, then you've got social insurance, and then you've got ACC. And this will then mean that you've got two quite different kinds of treatment, two kind of levels of assistance depending on your eligibility or not for social insurance. So that's the first thing. So you've got two tiers of welfare operating, which is, secondly, is we think is probably almost certainly going to mean there is much less attention to the position and needs of people on the very low benefits and on low incomes and in job situations where they don't qualify for social insurance because of contribution rates or because of time frames and so on. So that's probably the second bit. The third bit is that you've finished up with two sets of different rules. In the social insurance framework, you're entitled to 80% without any assessment of your partner's income. In social security, your eligibility for social security is very heavily influenced and indeed depends on what level of income your partner has. So there's a whole series of quite different sets of rules depending on how you qualify.
But in retrospect, though, because unlike a lot of other benefits, for example, student allowance that we are on in, the students could be allowed on in, that's means and asset tested. But this sort of social insurance is a means or asset tested. Shouldn't that be more beneficial for everyone?
Well, there's a good argument for kind of standardising and getting consistency across the systems as a whole. The Welfare Expert Advisory Group did a lot of good work 2.5 years ago around developing the welfare system so that it provided better support and so that there is a much more comprehensive levels of support. And that's only minimal amounts of that have been implemented. So I guess that one of the worries in this context is that the sort of the impetus, if you like, for reform and for developing some of that consistency that you're referring to begins to get lost because lots of attention and energy gets focused on the social insurance scheme.
So what is the alternative? A long-term, you said you want long-term welfare reform. So what will that look like?
Well, I think that the data is very clear that people on the lowest incomes, that's beneficiaries and people in low-paid jobs, the pressures on those families in that context has been been difficult for a long time, but even more difficult over the last year or two, as you've seen in the growing numbers using food banks and in numbers and hardship grants and so on. So for us, the first priority is, how do we develop the welfare system and welfare support so that children in the poorest households get the level of assistance that they need? And so that would be the starting point. And there's a lot of work that's been done on that and some changes which have been made, which have been important and valuable, but some of the momentum, I think, we think on that's been lost in the last 12 months or so. So the task now is to redevelop that momentum and not get lost in the focusing on a new part of a social support network.
Thanks for joining us. And that was Associate Professor Mike O'Brien, who is the Child Poverty Action Group Social Security spokesperson, talking to us about the government's new job insurance proposal. You're on 95 BFM and this is the Thursday Wire. It's 10 minutes past noon. We will be back after a quick break.
Up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and staying on the topic of the government's job insurance proposal, joining us now is the Council of Trade Unions President, Richard Wagstaff. Tēnā koe, Richard. So why should we need this job insurance scheme?
The motivator behind this is to better protect workers through change. We know that there are a lot of changes coming towards workers around the world. In New Zealand, we need to protect our workers better. So this idea was promoted by ourselves and by Business New Zealand and government in the Future Work Forum before COVID actually arrived on our shores. We were thinking about things like climate change, technology change, demographic change, and so on, and how industries are likely to be significantly disrupted in the years ahead, and how we need to protect workers through that change so that they can move from their jobs into better jobs and be reskilled and supported financially in that transition. And at the moment, there isn't really much transition. We know from research we've done that a lot of working people, they can't withstand a job change, and they find themselves facing real financial hardship and worried about putting food on the table and paying the mortgage or the rent. And New Zealand has a real gap here compared to other countries. You know, we look at places like Scandinavia where they have flex security, they have systems of really transitioning people from one job and industry to another. And we need to transition to low carbon industries in New Zealand. So that's where this came from.
Well, nowadays in New Zealand, there are a lot of people who are on part-time jobs, multiple jobs, contract work or other sort of type of jobs. Would this be covered? Will they be covered by this insurance scheme as well?
Yeah, we want to cover as many people as we can, including casuals, contractors, and all those kinds of people. And the proposal that's gone out is saying, you know, here are some ideas, how do we do that? The idea being that people who had a reasonable expectation of income, if that's cut short through no fault of their own, that there's a way of protecting their income for at least a few months.
So how does that work? We know that up to 80% of one's wages could be covered up to 7 or 8 months.
Yeah, so what would happen is that right now, if you lose your job, you can be sort of, put out the door very, very quickly without much warning and then left to fend for yourself and obviously try to get welfare. But that isn't very good if your partner's working, you don't get welfare. And it's quite a significant drop in income, and people who have rent to pay, mortgages and so on, can't sustain that, can't live there. What this proposal is saying is that your employer has to give you at least 4 weeks' notice, and then it's saying after that, the employer then has to put you on a bridging payment for another 4 weeks at least 80% of your pay. And then after that, you get another 6 months' pay, another 6 months income at 80% of your previous salary. During that period, you'll be actively looking for work, actively supported in case managed to find another job, and you'd be expected to take another job that paid at least as well as your old job. Otherwise, you could also seek to retrain, and you could remain on that salary, 80% of your salary, for up to a year if you're in a suitable retraining program. So it's very much focused on what we call active labour market policies, you know, finding ways to support people to new jobs, new employment. And we think that's going to be really important if we move to a low carbon economy.
Well, we have heard some criticisms of the scheme so far. The National Party and ACT Party, for instance, say this is a tax on jobs, while we have also talked to several welfare advocates who say the plan will only drive inequality. What do you think of that? Richard, can you hear me? Okay, we have a slight communication problem on that, but thanks so much to Richard Wagstaff, who is the president of the Council of Trade Unions, for joining us. It's 16 minutes past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after a quick break.
Hey, what's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
What? I don't know.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in six?
No idea, and I don't care.
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
Look, I know tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
DJs Bobby Brazuka and Gareth XMF.
Oh, go on.
And tomorrow,
DJs V and Grantis.
Sweet as, one of those actually solves 13 right, across.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m, only on 95BFM.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
A few days ago, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission presented an oral hearing for its recent submission on the Pyota Healthy Futures Bill. The bill will look to address existing inequities within the system and meet the needs who are underserved by this system. I spoke to Tammy Allen, the CEO of Changing Minds and board member of the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, on the matter.
So can you tell me a bit about the Pyota Healthy Futures Bill that you guys did the oral presentation for?
Yeah, certainly. So the Pyota bill, amongst other things, is going to be doing things like disestablishing district health boards and health promotion agency and setting up new agencies that look at all of health like Health New Zealand, you might have heard of, and the Māori Health Authority. So it's basically looking at large structural reforms across the health system that will contribute to better health and wellbeing outcomes for everyone.
Can you tell me about some of the inequities we see within the health sector in general?
So, I mean, basically, we think the bill is a good one. However, it needs quite a lot of work to ensure we're not just looking, because there's quite a lot of our communities that are currently underserved by our health system. And so, I mean, what we've said quite openly is that the current delivery of our health services is systemically racist. So what that means, it's not the people working within them, but the way the systems operate that can discriminate and prejudice against certain parts of our communities that are underserved. So those are our Māori and Pacific populations, and our rainbow and Asian communities who are growing in numbers but don't have a lead agency to advocate for their needs. So we want the bill strengthened to make sure that those communities have better equitable outcomes.
As well as this, we also see similar inequities within the mental health system for Māori, Pacifica, Asian communities, as well as LGBTQ communities. Can you tell me about that?
So the bill talks about all of health. So one of the things that we have advocated for really strongly is that there is no health without mental health. And because of those inequities that you just spoke of, we want the bill to make explicit reference of mental health and wellbeing as being prioritised within that. And to do that and to correct some of those inequities, we believe explicitly it has to be mentioned that Māori have to be represented at a governance level, that Māori need to have that power in the system that reflects and balances that power that the Crown currently have. And to do that, the organisations and providers within the public health system need to understand and recognise and reflect our, you know, our national need to uphold Te Tiriti o Waitangi. So that, and that reflects what we need for some of our other underserved populations as well, that we want to see the populations our health system is currently underserving reflected in the governance of those large organisations, not just simply consulted on, which is how the bill currently proposes the wording.
Hmm. So I guess with, so under PIORTA, it's a much more almost sophisticated approach to health issues rather than just normal consultations like we've done. There's dedicated agencies now for those issues.
Yeah, I think our critique of the bill, generally, we like the direction of structural reform, but our critique of it is how are we going to implement that? You know, and mental health is fairly invisible as a priority in the bill because they're talking of all of health, but the government has already made a commitment that mental health and wellbeing needs to be a focus, so that needs to be explicit in the bill if it's going to continue year after year in perpetuity. I mean, as you know, every single year, one in five of us will experience a mental illness or addiction diagnosis, distress. Up to 80% of New Zealanders tell us that they experience distress or addiction challenges in their lifetime. You know, that's most of the country. And, you know, regardless of our suicide statistics, 20,000 people attempt to take their life. And health is such an enormous burden if we're going to silo out physical health needs with our mental health and wellbeing needs. They need to actually be combined. And we've asked the bill to look at how they're going to strategically make sure that there's a monitoring of cross-agency efforts. And what I mean by cross-agency is that we know that, you know, your mental health and wellbeing and physical health and wellbeing aren't just something that comes and goes, but they're affected by social determinants, economics, financial determinants, the commercial interests of the wider sector and how that plays on our mental health and wellbeing, and just the wider environmental determinants of health. We think that that kind of writing needs to be implemented inside the bill.
Yeah.
Because otherwise cohesiveness and collaboration doesn't happen, if you know what I mean. It remains siloed and we get, you know, specialists concentrating on particular areas rather than a holistic system that all of our whānau and communities out there tell them that they need.
Now, does a bill like this come at a more significant time due to such uncertainty within society, you know, with a very lengthy lockdown last year plus Omicron. So does it come more timely than ever?
Absolutely. You know, we all know when we've heard over and over again that mental health is one of our greatest health burdens in Aotearoa and that it disproportionately impacts Māori and other disadvantaged groups that have already been disadvantaged for other things, including COVID-19. So we've heard a lot about vaccination being an issue for our Māori and Pacific populations in particular. It's also a huge issue for us for those who have lived experience of mental health and addiction issues, because they are the ones that are the most vaccine hesitant because of the trust that they have in the system as a whole. So we know that mental health, because of COVID-19, needs even more focus.
Is there anything else you want to add in terms of anything else you think people should know about this bill?
I think overall we should feel very positive about the bill. I think the fact that the Select Committee are hearing lots of different views on how it can be strengthened, we expect to see those views being implemented. We'd love to see a health and wellbeing plan being part of what the future health system does that will be entrenched in the bill. So I think that overwhelmingly people can feel that it's positive reform. Reform doesn't happen unless it's embedded in legislation. So this is a positive step towards the future that we all need. We just want to make sure that mental health and wellbeing is explicitly stated in the bill, because otherwise health, the physical aspects of health can sometimes be dominant and mental health and wellbeing can be siloed out.
Mm.
So I guess if we were asking people to kind of advocate for that, it would be to look at advocating for, you know, the governance of those populations that most need that focus, and that, you know, structural changes alone aren't going to be the answer. We need the whole system to be able to work with other parts of the system in order for those changes to stay, really, to stick.
That was Tammy Allen, the CEO of Changing Minds and a board member for the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission on the Paiora Healthy Futures Bill. If you are struggling with any mental health issues, please be sure to let someone know. That could be your local GP, or you could phone Healthline at 0800 611 116.
Thanks, Joe. It's 25 minutes past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. You're still listening to the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM, and we will be back after this.
Long suffering, you know you can't see nothing up ahead, so I pretend relentlessly. Backsliding is only fluke, you're not colliding with the up and coming trends you fail to see. You are not thick, not a fool. You're so much cleverer than me, but you're too cool. Your arm is so restricting, your naked flesh can't heal so far from it. Try shedding the direction that you're headed, it's not so hard adjusting here to there. Haven't failed, you're not a fool. You got so much that's yours alone, but you're too cool. Comforting, but I know deep down you're shitting as you sit alone. Thick, not a fool. So much can love than me, but you're too cool.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Animal rights activists from the Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses are opposing the holding of the Taranaki Cup. Last year, 25 horses died on New Zealand racetracks, along with many others in the days following due to injuries and complications sustained while racing. I spoke to Elin Arbez, a member of the Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses, on the impact of horse racing and their planned protest against the holding of the cup. Here she is now.
Can you tell me a bit about horse racing itself and why it's so detrimental to the health of horses and I guess why it's such a dangerous sport for them?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I guess if we start with the most extreme example first, 25 horses have died on New Zealand racetracks last year alone. I mean, that number kind of speaks for itself. If we had a sport where 25 human participants died in a year, you know, there'd be absolute outrage. And in that case, those would have been consenting participants, but these horses are not consenting participants. Injuries, serious injuries like pulmonary hemorrhages, which is bleeding in the lungs, and which you often then see by blood coming from the horse's nostrils, things like cardiac arrhythmias. These are frequently documented in the reports after the races. At New Plymouth Raceway alone, there have been 9 horses that have died on track over the last decade. At the end of the thoroughbred's life, while some are rehomed, there's about 3,000 that are unaccounted for annually. Over in Australia, investigators have scanned microchips of horses in slaughterhouses and have found New Zealand thoroughbreds in slaughterhouses where horses are slaughtered for human consumption. So, I mean, you know, from start to finish, these horses are subjected to exploitation and are ultimately cast aside when they're no longer profitable to the industry.
Now, how long would you say this has been going on for?
Since the inception of the industry, I think this industry is built on the exploitation and suffering of these animals. And while there have been advances in the welfare, there are still some very dark sides to this industry that the public are largely unaware of.
You guys are planning on protesting at the Taranaki Cup, which is coming up this weekend. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So members of Taranaki Animal Save, we have been present at every race over the last year at New Plymouth Raceway. We have, where possible, we have had a public presence to protest to try and raise awareness. Most of the public are largely unaware of what goes on with horse racing, as the horse racing industry has waned greatly in popularity. It often the broader public are no longer engaged with it. A lot of people don't go along to the races anymore and are not even aware they're on, kind of thing. And so because of this, the racing industry are able to get away with a lot of what they get away with. So by having a public presence there, we kind of try to remind people of what's happening behind the scenes. And we also take the opportunity to gather footage, videos and photos of the horses. And we've accumulated quite a collection of footage of horses being punched, being whipped, being pushed so forcefully that their hind legs leave the ground, you know, being abused, being sworn at, you know, which we just, you know, gathered to build a further case of why this industry needs to be abolished, frankly.
I'm also reading that 9 horses have been killed at New Plymouth Raceway alone.
And it should also be noted that those are just the ones that we are aware of. There is, those are the ones that died immediately on track. There are often horses that die in the following days after the races that may not be recorded.
Do you think that with this protest, could we see any more in the future, especially at other horse racing events?
Yeah, I think from our experiences going along to these big events, the Boxing Day events and stuff like that, what we often witness is that they are often quite big social occasions, but most people seem to be pretty oblivious to the horses, to be honest. I think a lot of people do treat it as a social occasion to go out and have some drinks with friends and gamble and stuff. But to be frank, I think it could be replaced with just about any other sport, and those people would still be going along to those events. I think there's going to be increasing pressure on the horse racing industry over the coming year as more and more people become aware of the underlying reality of it.
Are there any other raceways, or are there any other horse racing venues around the country which may not have had light shed on them in terms of this issue?
Oh, most definitely. I think in most cases it's the majority of them. Unfortunately, you know, the animal rights community in New Zealand is quite small in scale to the horse racing industry kind of thing. So it's a matter of being able to cover what we can, where we can. There's a lot of raceways where what is going on is a lot worse, but we just don't have the people there to document that. But I would hope that moving forward, as more people become aware of this, I would hope that more people take it upon themselves to actually become involved in this and interested in this and go along and do what we do, you know, get footage and document this and actually raise awareness of this so that, you know, it's, you have to expose the sunlight on this industry. Yeah.
Now, is there anything else you feel that the public should know or that people in New Zealand should know about this industry?
No, I think really the takeaway is this industry is on the way out. You know, if it weren't for the $70 million bailout that Winston Peters gave them over COVID, it probably would have been the end of the industry kind of thing. It's much like greyhound racing, you know, it's a Swansea industry, but for the horses that are being viciously abused and exploited on a regular basis, you know, the end won't come soon enough. So it's up to people to boycott where they can and draw attention where they can for the horses. Yeah.
That was Elena Bez from the Coalition for the Protection of Racehorses on the impact of horse racing and their protest against the holding of the Taranaki Cup.
Thanks very much, Joe. If you have any thoughts on all the stories we have done so far, we've talked about the jobs insurance scheme that the government proposed yesterday, a submission by the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission to the Health Sector Reform Bill that will be passed, that was supposed to be come into force in July this year, as well as New Zealand citizens who are stuck in Afghanistan, which we will be talking about later, as well as, yeah, and you can let us know what you think about Joe's story of the protection of racehorses against the Taranaki Cup. And yeah, the Prime Minister has also just announced the 5-stage reopening New Zealand's border program, which New Zealand citizens in Australia will be exempt from going into MIQ starting at the end of this month. And while New Zealanders at the rest of the country can come back starting in March. So let me know if you're excited for at that prospect. The time is 24 to 1 here in Auckland. We will be back after another break.
You're listening to Talking Tracks on PBNZ.
And as I said, Frith, if this harpsichord is gauche, then what's Max Martin? Seriously though, a crisp and, dare I say, ebullient debut from this young artist. Mm. And now from our new contributor, Daryl.
Yeah, mate.
Are you trying to humiliate me?
No.
Is this funny to you? Screeching uncultured no-fi bullshit? Get out!
Real pain for sham friends. Dirtbag Radio for real friends.
Cause I wanna go out and get drunk and dance. I got a fake ID.
Dirtbag Radio. Mondays 7 to 9 p.m. with Rackley. Only on 95 BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and for our final story of today, at least two groups of Afghan nationals who have families in New Zealand and had visas to travel here are still stuck in Afghanistan, as the government said they are not eligible for resettlement services. The group of Afghans, whose families helped the New Zealand Defence Force and since resettled here, won legal proceedings in the High Court last November, which ordered Immigration New Zealand to promptly process and grant them their visas. Now, advocates for them say the government is withholding critical safe travel assistance and wants the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade to extend the coverage of its Afghanistan Departure Task Force services to the group. Sue Moroney is the Community Law Centre's Aotearoa Chief Executive, and she spoke to me this morning, and I began by asking her more details of the group.
Well, this group of people are basically stuck in life-threatening situations because Immigration New Zealand unlawfully suspended the processing of their visas back in March 2020 when the borders closed. They actually had to, through community law, take their case right through to the High Court to get a judgment that forced Immigration New Zealand to start processing their visas again. And that judgment just came out at the end of November last year. So, you know, almost 2 years it took to actually get Immigration New Zealand to recognise that they had acted unlawfully in suspending the processing of these family support category visas, which are for people who have family here already in New Zealand. So most of the families here in New Zealand are refugees because of their connection to and work for the New Zealand Defence Force in Afghanistan. So they are relatives of people who already live here. They have refugee status, and they've been wanting for a number of years now to come and join their family members here in Aotearoa. So that's who this group are. They've already been disadvantaged once substantially by one wing of the New Zealand government through Immigration New Zealand taking that unlawful action to suspend their visa applications. They now face further discrimination from another arm of government with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs withdrawing the available support to help them safely travel from Afghanistan once their visas are issued.
So AMFAD told the Herald yesterday that the visa issued as a result of the judicial review back in November don't fit the scope of the Afghanistan task force that was created to help evacuate New Zealanders from Afghanistan. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we think this is just a bureaucratic tangle. At the time when the New Zealand government's cabinet made the decision on the criteria for who qualified for assistance from the Afghanistan Departure Task Force, the New Zealand government believed them to be ineligible at the time. So, of course, they didn't include them in the criteria because at that time, before the High Court instructed them otherwise, they didn't believe that they would get valid visas anyway. That High Court judgment has subsequently happened. They are now getting valid resident visas for New Zealand. And really what we need the Cabinet to do is to go back and fix this up and extend the support to them so that the bureaucratic tangle doesn't continue to happen where they are excluded by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from that support simply because Cabinet didn't include them at the time. And at the time, Cabinet couldn't include them because they weren't recognising them as being visa holders.
But, okay, so currently the court case involves two of your clients who are families of those of New Zealand citizens. How many others are there, are you aware of, that are in a similar situation?
So the two clients from Community Law Waikato who took the High Court case were representative of 77 applicants in total. Now, because that High Court decision came out in their favour, that actually sets a precedent for an unknown number of other people who are in the same situation as them. We don't know what that number is because they are not our clients, but we estimate that there's somewhere between 1 and 200 people who fall into this category.
How many of them are still in Afghanistan?
Well, all of the 77 are still in Afghanistan. Only 17 of them, 17 of the 77 who took the court case have had their resident visas approved. So they are now eligible to come here. But none of them have been able to safely make their way here yet because we can't get this this government assistance to help them travel safely. We've already faced a scenario last year where some of our clients made the treacherous trip from Kabul to the border at Pakistan, and in crossing that border, the family were all beaten. They were all attacked and beaten, and the elderly father of that family died as a result of his injuries. So, you know, the threat is real in terms of how dangerous it is to make that make those crossings without the facilitation of having government-to-government talks. And they can only happen between state governments. It's not something that a community law centre can do, and it's certainly not something that an individual person can do from Afghanistan, as, you know, broker those sorts of agreements with governments in places like Pakistan and Iran.
That was Sue Maroney from the Community Law Centre, or Aotearoa. And in case you have missed it from earlier this morning, the government has announced a five-stage reopening plan for New Zealand's borders. So the first stage, starting on step one, from 11:59pm on February 27th, which is Sunday, New Zealand's borders will be reopened to New Zealanders and other eligible travellers under current border settings from Australia. And those exceptions include critical health workers, dairy farm managers and assistants, shearers and wool handlers, deep water fishing crew, rural contractors, vets, teachers, international students, major infrastructure projects, tech sector workers, external auditors, government-approved events and programs, and other short and long-term critical workers. Step two will be implemented on March 13th, and it will reopen the borders to New Zealanders and other eligible travellers under the current border settings to the rest of the world. And it will also reopen to skilled workers earning at least 1.5 times the median wage, and those who are on working holiday visas can also come back. Step three will be starting on April 12th, which will reopen to offshore temporary visa holders who can still meet the relevant visa requirements, and up to 5,000 international students who will be in time for semester two. And there will be also further exceptions for critical workforces that do not meet the 1.5 times the median wage under step two. And under step four, by July this year, anyone in Australia will be free to travel to New Zealand, and those who have visa waiving programs with New Zealand will be also free to enter the country, and the accredited employer work visa will open, meaning the skilled and health worker border exception can be phased out. The final step will be by October this year, and the border will be fully reopened to visitors from anywhere in the rest of the world. And all those entering New Zealand's borders will still need to be fully vaccinated and spend time in home isolation, and will have to do PCR tests and couple one day or another, while MIQ will still be there for those who are unvaccinated. If you have any thoughts on that, let me and Joe know by text on 5395. Are you excited to see this happening, or are you excited to see your family, or do you have any plans for your family in Australia or the rest of the world to come back to New Zealand, or just admit you want to leave the country to go to the rest of the world traveling again? Let me know. The text number is 5395, or if you want to call us, the number is 309-3879. Another break right now, but we'll be back after a bit. So, Joe, you have been trawling on social media since the announcement on the border. What have you got?
So I've just been going through Twitter, looking at the reaction from the world about the border reopening. Right here we have the immigration spokesperson for the Green Party, Ricardo Menendez. He says, from an immigration perspective in relationship to the border reopening timeline, family reunification should be prioritized. Inequities between visa waiver and non-visa countries, e.g. UK, US versus India remain, and migrants who've been stuck offshore should be offered replacement visas as well. So very interesting. We have a few more tweets. A lot of people just, mainly people sharing their opinion on the border as well, and just tweeting the news. But definitely something quite exciting. Definitely returning back to normalcy, somewhat, I guess. Do you plan on traveling?
Possibly. If my wallet permits me to do so, I will. And you?
Possibly a stint over in Japan for a bit. That's the goal. Always wanted to go see Japan.
The National Party has also formally responded to this news. Its leader, Christopher Luxon, says today's announcement is a victory for the 100,000 people who signed the party's petition to end MIQ, and it's also good news for businesses and workplaces that rely on New Zealand being open to the world so they can get critical workers they need into the country. And we will probably have more reaction to that on The Wire tomorrow with Jess and Liam.
That was The Wire.
Ko ora te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire for today, February 3rd, and big news day as well. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me kia mātou mo tēnei rā, thanks to those who spoke to us today. E whakaro ana koe ki te irirangi pōho, you're still tuned in to 95BFM. Thanks to Joe for your work today.
Thank you so much for having me. Busy, very, very busy news day as well. And thank you for remembering my name this week, Justin.
Well, I've already written that on my hand this time, in case you haven't seen that.
Well, thank you so much.
Secret is here for the 124 now. For the next 3 hours, but until next week, enjoy the long weekend and we will see you soon. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.